So, let's begin by cultivating our motivation. So, let's rejoice at being alive, having the opportunity that we have to listen to teachings and to put them into practice. And let's make a strong determination to really take advantage of this opportunity. So instead of taking our life for granted and the good fortune that we have to hear the Buddhist teachings for granted, let's really appreciate and make a strong intention to use this opportunity very wisely. And the best way to use this opportunity is to listen, reflect, and meditate on the teachings for the purpose of attaining full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. Let's cultivate that bodhicitta motivation for what we're about to do. Okay. So the last teachings, we've been talking about far-reaching wisdom. Okay? And there being different kinds of wisdom, the wisdom that understands conventional phenomena and how they function together, the wisdom that understands the ultimate nature of how things exist, and third, the wisdom that understands how to benefit sentient beings. So we've been talking specifically about the second kind of wisdom, the wisdom that understands the ultimate nature. And the reason this is important is because the root of all of our problems is the fact that we misapprehend things, that we don't know how things really exist. And instead, we have a lot of false conceptions and false ways of grasping. And this just creates a ton of problems for us. Okay? So what lies at the root of this is the self, okay? And the self is important, yeah, because we have a self. We say myself, yourself, themselves, whatever. And it's the self that does actions. It's the self that experiences results. It's the self that is born again and again in cyclic existence, and it's even the self, the person, that attains enlightenment and liberation. So the self is something important. But our present way of apprehending the self is incorrect. Okay? And because we misapprehend how the self exists, then we get involved in a lot of other antics, to put it mildly. Okay? So let's look at the evolution a little bit more. What is this wrong way that we perceive the self and other phenomena to exist? Okay. Whereas things exist dependently on other factors, we presently tend to just see and experience things as having their own independent entity, okay? Existing on their own, existing under their own power, having some kind of objective existence out there, independent of us, right? Yeah, you see things that way? It's like, okay, here's a bottle of water. Yeah, the way we look at it, it's like, yeah, that's a bottle of water. You know, It's not a pumpkin. Yeah, it's not a platypus. It's a bottle of water. And any idiot who walks in the room should know this is a bottle of water. Don't you agree? Isn't that how we look at it? Yeah? Why? Well, because it's just a bottle of water. Can't you see? Any idiot knows that. Okay? So we're seeing that there's something in here that makes it a bottle of water, independent of our mind. Okay? It's objectively a bottle of water because everybody should come in and recognize it as such. And so we just assume that everything we see, everything we contact, exists in that way, with its own inherent essence or nature, something in it that makes it what it is. Right? This telephone. Again, any idiot knows it's a telephone. Yeah. It has no relationship to my mind, to your mind. It's a telephone from its own side. That's how we see those things. Okay? So, this is actually a wrong way of grasping things, of holding things to exist. Because in actual fact, things don't have their own essence that's findable inside of them, but instead they arise dependently on other things that are not them. Okay? So let's come back to our bottle of water again. Okay? So the bottle of water arose due to a plastic factory, right? Due to some scientists who developed plastic. Due, probably many different people, we have various kinds of plastic. And, you know, some kind of, I wouldn't call this paper, some other kind of artificial substance that somebody invented. And there were some graphic designers that wrote Albertsons Natural Spring Water. So again, it depends on Albertsons. Okay, it doesn't say Costco. There's more designers because the bottles have, you know, these kind of waves in them. I don't know if that's to grip or to make it beautiful or whatever it is. But, you know, there were many, many different people involved in producing this water bottle. And there were many, many different substances involved in producing this water bottle. None of those substances and none of those people is a water bottle. The plastic's not a water bottle, is it? Yeah. The label's not a water bottle. The scientists who invented the plastic are not a water bottle. The marketing company, you know, not a water bottle. But all these things came together to produce a water bottle. But none of the things which the water bottle depended on for its coming into existence is a water bottle. So where did the water bottle come from? What makes it a water bottle? If the plastic isn't a water bottle, and the label's not a water bottle, and the top's not a water bottle, and the people who made it and who advertised it aren't water bottles, then what makes this a water bottle? Can you find something that is a water bottle here? Can you find something that's a water bottle here? You can't, can you? Something that comes from its own side that we can draw a line around and say, that's the water bottle. Getting some kind of feeling for what I'm saying? So, where did the water bottle come from? It came from different things that are not water bottles coming together. And, very important, our conceptual process and our agreement to give the label to this thing and call it water bottle. Without our mind seeing this in a certain way and using it to perform a certain function and giving it that name water bottle, without that, this would not be a water bottle. Would it? Okay. So the water bottle depends on its causes and conditions. It depends on the parts that compose it. And it depends on our minds that conceive and label it as a water bottle. But inside of this thing, there is nothing that makes it a water bottle from its own side, independent of everything else. You with me so far? Okay. Now you're going to go, yeah, that's very nice, but how does that solve my problems? Okay. Well, let's take the example of money. Yeah, water bottles, we don't have a lot of passion about. Okay, I hope not. Money, on the other hand, we have a little bit more energy about money, don't we? Okay. What is money? It's paper and ink, isn't it? That's all it is paper and ink. That is cut, paper's cut in a certain size, the ink's put on in a certain way, they make that watermark, which is different than the watermarks I make when I spill water on it. I make different kind of watermarks. But, you know, it's basically paper and ink. And why does it have value? Does that paper have any value in and of itself? It doesn't, does it? It only has value, again, because all of us agreed to impute value on those pieces of paper. It's the only reason it has value. If we didn't give it that meaning, if we didn't use it to perform a certain function, if we didn't conceive of it as money or as valuable, it would be totally worthless. So, you know, it's kind of like if somebody gave us some bills from a currency, from a society that we didn't know and never went to, those bills are totally worthless. Yeah? And we might even use them for jotting our notes down, you know, our shopping list or something like that. So something only has value because we, our minds, give it value. And because it's composed of parts and arises out of causes and conditions, it doesn't have that from its own side, inside of it. Okay? Yet, look at everything we impute on money. Not only do we impute the word money and the meaning of money as something that we trade to get things. Yeah? I mean, it's really kind of a good deal, isn't it? You give somebody paper and they give you something you can use. It's a good deal. Yeah, I mean, otherwise you have these dollar bills. What are you going to use them for? Can't eat them. Can't wear them. Don't make very good shelter. But you trade them and somebody gives you something really useful. But we not only, you know, use money as that kind of means of exchange, but we impute even more on money. We impute our whole self-worth on money. At least some people do. You know, what I am worth is the number of zeros in my bank account. You see, number of zeros? Because it is. The first number in your cumulative wealth is not so important. If it's a 1, 2, 9, You know, that number's not so important. It's how many zeros follow it. 1 0, 2 0. 6 zeros? Good. Not enough. 7 zeros is better. That makes you into the... 6 zeros makes you into the millions. Okay. Whether it's 1 million, 9 million, it's the number of zeros. Add another zero, you get a 10 million, then 100 million, trillion. Okay? So, we impute in our society now almost our whole value of our life is the amount of money we make. For many people, this is really the case. You know, why do we have self-esteem? Because we have money. There's a very interesting little exercise that you could do. I've done it at retreats, and it's really fascinating. And we ask people to think, you know, to do some reflection on what money means to them. Yeah. And for some people, money means freedom. Okay? The number of these pieces of paper you have means freedom. For some people, it means power. For some people, it means fame and recognition or prestige. For some people, money means love. Because you can give people presents by using money. Yeah? For some people, money means respect. Because people respect you if you have money. Like I said, you have power if you have money. You have freedom if you have money. You're worthwhile as a human being if you have money. Okay. So we have all these different kinds of thoughts that we've imputed onto some pieces of paper. And that's why all day everybody's scrambling about these pieces of paper, trying to get more and more of them. Okay? But where does all of that come from? Yeah? Does the money really give you power? Is there power inside that paper? Let's use this piece of paper. A nice big yellow bill. Yeah? Is there power inside of this? Or fame? Or love? Or self-worth? Or proving yourself to your parents, or being better than your siblings? Any of that in a piece of paper? Nothing. Nothing. It all comes from our mind projecting onto it. Okay? But when we don't realize what we've projected onto things, and instead we think that it has meaning or purpose or is what it is inherently from its own side, that's when we get into trouble. Because wouldn't you say that when people get very stuck on the idea that money is power, wouldn't you say that that's unhealthy? For if they think money is love, it's unhealthy, isn't it? Or money is my self-worth. Not very healthy. No. Dare I say most of us are stuck on those kind of concepts? It's not very healthy. But why are we stuck on them? Because we forgot that we were the ones that put those meanings and those concepts on these silly pieces of paper. Yeah? So we create this whole trip about money. Yeah? That is totally coming from our own mind. Totally coming from our own mind. And very misery making, too, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay? So there's an example of how, you know, not seeing what money is, what it actually is, can lead to suffering. So if we see money as paper and ink, then we're not going to suffer so much about how much of it we have. because it's just paper and ink. That's it. Okay? You getting what I'm saying? Yeah? Making some sense? Okay. So, you know, we do this with so many different things. We might be very attached to something. Maybe there's some piece of jewelry. Yeah, it's been in the family for many, you know, generations, some special piece of jewelry, you know, some diamond ring or whatever it is. Diamond is basically rock. Just a rock. Why is a diamond valuable? Is it valuable from its own side? No. Yeah. It's just a rock, for goodness sake. Yeah. All the value in a diamond comes from our imputing value to that rock. We could have easily imputed the same value to a piece of gravel out there in the parking lot. It's true, isn't it? Isn't it? Yeah. But look at what our minds do about a diamond ring. And then a diamond ring that's been in the family for generations. Okay. Is your grandmother inside that diamond ring? Now? Or your great-grandfather? Or the whole family history? Or all the genes and the meaning of all those people's lives? Is that in that rock? None of it's there, is it? Then why, if we lose that diamond ring, do we go bananas? Now, me, my mother, you know, she's been dead for so many years, but she's going to be so unhappy. Great grandmother and my great great grandfather, and I've just broken the whole treasure of the family that everybody was thinking that I was going to preserve for all of posterity, and blah blah blah. We get ourselves pretty wound up, don't we? You know, we can really do good numbers and make ourselves very miserable. And it's totally coming from our own mind. Nowhere in that piece of rock. Nowhere. Okay. Last time I was, last week I was talking about reputation and how we're very attached to reputation. Because we think our reputation also exists from its own side, with its own nature, you know. And we care a lot about our reputation, don't we? But we all say, no, no, no. I don't care what other people think of me, you know. That's their business. If they don't like me, that's their problem. We all say that, don't we? But if we hear somebody's talking behind our back, you know, we stop saying that. And it's really important. Somebody is talking about my bad qualities behind my back. I don't have any bad qualities. I made a simple mistake. Why are they saying it's a bad quality? You know. Okay, so we go on and on. Then we get defensive. We get aggressive. You know, we go home and have a pity party. You know, because we're so attached to our reputation. What is the basis of label for reputation? On what do we label reputation? We really care about our reputation. But what is a reputation? Can you find anything that you can put a circle around and say this is a reputation? Is it what they print in the newspapers? Is it what one person says about you? Is it what another person says about you? What really is a reputation? Okay, we're attached to this thing, but what is it really that we're attached to? Can you find it? We can't, can we? What's this reputation? Yeah. So on further reflection, you know, we can't find something that's our reputation. But I think we give the label reputation to what we call the basis of the label or the basis of designation. You know, what is that basis that we call reputation? It's other people's thoughts. Okay, so my reputation is other people's thoughts. Isn't it? Yeah, my reputation isn't my thought. My reputation are other people's thoughts. Okay, what are other people's thoughts? Sit with that for a minute. What are other people's thoughts? Well, if their mind is anything like our mind, the thoughts come and go very quickly, don't they? Yeah, they don't stay for very long. And just as we are very busy thinking about ourselves and don't have much time to think about anybody else, the other people are also very busy thinking about themselves. And believe it or not, they really don't spend a lot of time thinking about us. And yet, we're so attached to those little blips of energy that pass through their mind that have our name associated with it. It's really rather peculiar, isn't it? Why are we so attached to our reputation? You know, it's like trying to hold your reputation. There's nothing you can hold. You know, there's nothing there. And when we can really see this in a very deep way, that's when we really lose the attachment to our reputation. Okay? Because we realize, actually, there's nothing there. Just other people's thoughts, which come, which go, which may or may not have anything at all to do with me. Okay. So why do I need to worry so much about my reputation? Why do I need to do so many backflips to try and impress people so that I have a good reputation? Why do I need to spend so much angry getting upset, so much energy getting angry and upset with the blips that pass through people's minds, you know, have some kind of unfavorable picture of me? Really doesn't make much sense, does it? Doesn't make much sense. But then we say, well, it's because it's me. They're talking about me. Me. You know, this is no ordinary thing. It's me. Incidentally, happens to be the center of the universe. Okay. But there's a big me there, isn't there? They're talking about me. They said, Tupton children, me. I saw them over in that corner whispering, and I heard Tupton children. What are they saying about me? Okay. Now, what's very interesting is to ask ourselves, who's the me that they're talking about? Who's the me that they're talking about? We say, me! Right here, me! Well, who? Who? When we go, they're talking about me! What's that me? Who's that me? Is it your body? Is it your mind? Is it something else besides your body and mind? Do you have some kind of permanent soul that's there? Who's this me that they're all talking about? This me, you know. You know me. The feeling of me. You know the feeling of me? I sat here and said, you're all jerks, then you'd really have the feeling of me, wouldn't you? Who does she say, me, I'm a jerk? Who does she think she is? But it's very interesting when that feeling comes up. Jerk? Me? No way, you know. Who? We feel like there's a person there that's being attacked. But who exactly is that person? Okay. So when we label person, you know, label person, Sam, Joe, Nancy, whoever it is, it's independence upon a body and mind. Okay, wouldn't you say that? Independence upon a body and mind, we say so-and-so's there. So if we're going to look for the person, we have to either find it when we search inside the body and mind or separate from the body and mind. Okay? So if we look inside the body, okay, are you inside your body? Are you your body? Put it this way. Are you your body? You know, the ancients used to think, our pineal gland, it's up here, isn't it? Somewhere? Who's the top? Where's the pineal gland? Yeah, back there, somewhere inside the head, okay. So they used to think that that's where the person was. Yeah? Like there was some guy there, you know, like Wizard of Oz, you know, pulling the switches. There's me in my pineal gland. Okay? Yeah? Are you your pineal gland? Somebody put your pineal gland there on the table. Is that you? You say, it's my brain. I'm my brain. Because we feel very much like there's an I inside here somewhere, don't we? I'm my brain. Especially, you know, scientists are all telling us, you know, oh, you have so many, you know, you have a tendency to this and a tendency for that, and it's because of your brain. You are your brain. Yeah. It was very interesting. Many years ago, I was at a conference with some scientists and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and there was one scientist there who was a real reductionist, you know. Everything is the body, you know. Mind is just a property of the body. It's a property of the brain. And so His Holiness asked him, he said, well, if you saw somebody's brain sitting there on the table, would you say, hi, Mary, how are you doing today? Would you? Is your brain you? Your brain you? If your brain's out there? You ever been to an autopsy? Yeah? In America, they don't let you do it so much, do they? Yeah, you have to get special permission. In Thailand, you know, it's a Buddhist country, and so seeing the nature of the body is part of your Dharma practice. So they'll let the monks and nuns go to autopsies. So when I was there a couple of years ago, I requested to be able to go to an autopsy. So very interesting, you know, when they do the autopsy. And, you know, they cut here, and then they cut here and peel it back, and then little drill, and you know, cut around here and pop it off, and then they reach their hands in and go boop, and out comes the brain, you know, and they put it on a scale, you know, weigh it, the same kind of scale you weigh your vegetables on in the supermarket, you know. And so I was just thinking, you know, they put a brain on the table, you know. And is that a person? Is that who you are? They preserved your brain. Are they preserving you? Now, when you love somebody, do you look at their brain and say, I love you? Yeah? Brain is just a piece of vegetable goo. Isn't it? That's all it is. It's organic vegetable goo. natural vegetable goo. Okay. That's all it is. It's not a person. Yeah. So is there any part of this physical thing here that is who we are? No. So then we'd say, well, maybe I'm my mind. Am I my mind? That sounds nice. Yeah, I'm my mind. What's your mind? What's your mind? Western society doesn't have a clue. Yeah. Go look up in an encyclopedia brain, page after page. Look up mind. Hardly anything. Yeah, Western society, we don't know what the mind is. In Buddhism, we talk a lot about what the mind is. Okay? The mind is clarity and knowing. It's what has the ability to reflect and engage in objects. It's not form. You can't touch it. You can't measure it with scientific instruments because it's not made out of atoms and molecules. So it doesn't have color or shape or any of these things. So are we our mind? If we are, which consciousness are we? The visual consciousness that sees, the audio consciousness that hears, the olfactory consciousness that smells, the gustatory consciousness that tastes, the tactile consciousness that feels physical things, the mental consciousness which thinks. Yeah. Are we one of those consciousnesses? Or maybe you're your moods? If you're your mood, which mood are you? We change moods very quickly, don't we? So which mood are we? Well, I'm all the moods. So that means there's many yous? Because each self, each you is a different mood? Doesn't make much sense, does it? So it's hard to find a person amongst the consciousnesses, you know, and the different mental factors. So then we think, ah, I am my higher self. Yeah, let's get a little bit New Age pizzazz in here. Okay, I am my higher self. I am my soul. What's that? What's that? Use your analytical wisdom. What's your soul? What's your higher self? Draw a line around it. What is it? If it's not your body and it's not your mind, that means it's something different than your body and mind. Which means I could be sitting here and my higher self and my soul could be over there. Right? So when you say children, who are you calling? Me who's sitting there or my soul that's over there? You getting what I'm saying? Yeah? Can we have a person that's separate from the body and mind? Yeah? Is there any person totally separate that has no mind at all? Now, I know sometimes we're mindless, but I'm talking about different in a different way. Okay? So what we're getting at is independence upon the collection of the body and mind. We give the label person, just as in the collection of the, you know, the bottle and the label and the top. We give the label water bottle. But just as there was no water bottle inside this thing, then there's no person that you can find with the aggregates, with the body and mind. And just as you can't have this thing sitting here and say the water bottle's over there, can you? In the same way, we can't have the body and mind here and say the person is some kind of soul or higher self or something that's totally unrelated to the body and mind. Okay? So what we're getting at is that what we call I or person is something that exists by being merely labeled, by merely having the consensus of our conceptual mind agreeing that when there is a body and a mind together, we call that a person. And that's how a person exists. Not as anything findable, but only as something that exists by being labeled. In the same way that money has no value in and of itself, it only has value because we imputed that and gave it that meaning. Okay? You getting what I'm saying? So when we're feeling that very strong sense of me, you know, we were just talking about reputation, they're talking about me! Me! How dare they criticize me and say bad things about me behind my back? Who is that me when we search? We can't find anything to pinpoint. Okay. All we find is something that exists by concept and label in dependence upon a body and mind. That's all we find. Yeah. Or that's all that's there. We don't even find that, do we? Because if we look for the body, we're going to have the same thing. What part of this is the body? Is your arm your body? Is your leg your body? You know, same thing with the mind. You look in all the parts. Can you find the mind? Okay. So what we're getting at is that you see this fundamental misapprehension that we have? Whereas things are dependent, the person is dependent on a body and a mind, on causes and conditions, on our conceptual consciousness, and on a label. You know, that's how a person comes into existence. Well, instead of seeing people as dependent phenomena, we think that there's some real person, something incredibly unique or personal or some real self somewhere there. Okay. And it's on that basis that we then get quite attached to ourselves or quite attached to other people or very ego-sensitive about what other people say about us or think about us. But all this angst that we experience, either the attachment or the aversion or the resentment or the jealousy, you know, or the arrogance, it all comes because of our fundamental misconception, thinking that things have their own inherent nature inside them, whereas they don't. Okay, you with me? So, you know, why this whole issue of emptiness is important. Yeah, because when we're talking about emptiness, we're not talking about nothingness. We're talking about things being empty of having their own inherent nature. We're not talking about them being non-existent. They're empty of the false ways of existence that we project on them. Okay. Why this topic is important is because if we can see that things arise dependently but don't have their own inherent nature, then we're not going to grasp at things and make big deals about things that have no inherent nature. And then our minds are going to be so much more relaxed. So much more relaxed. Let me give you another example, maybe, of how our minds could be more relaxed when we realize dependent nature. Yeah? So one of the big C words, there's two C words that we're terribly afraid of. One is cancer and the other is commitment. Okay. I'm not sure which people are more afraid of. They seem to be terrified of both. Okay. But we, you know, if we look at what we call cancer, we think of cancer as something, don't we? Oh, they're doing tests for cancer. Maybe I have cancer. It's something that we have. Yeah. Before, you know, there was a time when the word cancer was just a sound and it didn't refer to any specific disease or anything like that. And how, you know, cancer came into existence is there were a bunch of symptoms that had that when people had certain configurations of these symptoms, they were kind of repeated. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying this very clearly, that different people would have certain groups of symptoms. Okay? We labeled those groups of symptoms cancer. Okay, that's all cancer is a convenient term that refers to a group of symptoms. But in our mind, do we think of cancer as a label that is given to a group of symptoms? No. We think of cancer as a thing. You know, something separate with its own solid, concrete identity, such that if I have it, it's cause for me to go bananas, you know, and get terrified. But all the term cancer refers to is just a group of symptoms. That's all. Nothing more than that. Okay? Would it change your mind if you, let's say, you know, you had some disease, whether you had kidney disease or AIDS or cancer or heart disease or, you know, emphysema or whatever you had. If instead of giving the disease one label, one term, if you just thought, I have a group of symptoms, would that change your feeling, your mood, your attitude towards your health? What do you think? It would, wouldn't it? Yeah? If you just said, oh, I have a group of 3, 4, 5 symptoms. Yeah? Group of symptoms. Okay, they're not so pleasant, but just a group of symptoms. And they all change, don't they? The symptoms are always changing all the time. Yeah? They're not permanent there. They're changing. You'd have a very different feeling about your body than if you said, I have kidney disease, or I have cancer, or I have congestive heart failure. Now, why? Simply because when we use labels to refer to a group of symptoms, and that's fine, no problem with that. But then we forget that that word is just a label that enables us to talk about something in a convenient way, and instead we think it's a real thing that's there. And then we get so emotional and so reactive to it. Okay? So this is how, if we're able to realize that things are empty of having their own inherent nature, but they do exist dependently, you know, it helps to relax our mind. It helps to release anger and resentment and release greed and attachment and release a lot of confusion that we have. Okay. So this is why understanding emptiness is important. Okay. So let me pause here. Maybe you have some questions or comments. This is your chance. Alec, is anybody typing in questions?
Can you explain the sentence, emptiness is born and
Okay. In the Heart Sutra, which is one very short sutra that the Buddha spoke, a sutra is a discourse. There's one sentence that says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. So, 25 words or less. Actually, there's a whole huge teaching on this. What it means is form, first of all, refers to color, shape, sound, smell, you know, all the sensual objects. That all gets put in the category of form. And what it means is that form is empty of having its own nature. Okay? And that emptiness of having its own nature is not something separate from form. Okay? So whenever we have anything, we have the water bottle and we also have the emptiness of inherent existence of the water bottle. We're talking about emptiness, we're not talking about it being empty of water. We're talking about it being empty of its own nature, empty of inherent existence. That emptiness of inherent existence and the water bottle are together. They can't be separated. Why? Because the emptiness of inherent existence is the ultimate nature, excuse me, the deeper mode of existence of the water bottle. So what it's getting at is that the ultimate nature is right here with everything right now. Because sometimes we think, oh, ultimate nature, it's like way far away in outer space somewhere, you know? And it's not. The deeper mode of existence is right here with everything right now, including our own deeper mode of existence. Okay? The emptiness of inherent existence of each of us as a person is right here. Yeah? And the person is not separated from its emptiness of inherent existence, just as the water bottle and its emptiness of inherent existence aren't separable. Okay? Yeah?
Talk a little more about the self. And you seem to explain away the virtue and the energy of essence. You each have a essence, energy, that makes us who we are. We are actually motivated by that essence, which you might call mind, you might call soul, spirit, but there is this special and individual essence in the human being that causes your character, your motivations, your energies. How do you describe that?
Okay, so you're saying that there's an essence that's unique and individual and personal to each living being that determines our character and who we are.
Not wholly, because we're affected by our environment, by our peers,
yeah,
by our genetics and so on.
Okay, so we're affected by external influences.
Energy of life, energy of it's life, but it's not essential life, it's spiritual.
Okay, so some kind of essence of spiritual life.
Yes.
That is who we are.
Yes.
This is the thing that we are analyzing to try and find out if it exists. Okay?
Yes.
So let's not take its existence for granted. But instead, let's analyze and see if we can find something that is this essence of our character, or essence of life, or whatever it is. Okay? Because if we look, you know, we don't have a permanent personality. We don't have an unchanging static personality or character, do we? We talk about it like we do. Oh, so-and-so is very temperamental, you know. So-and-so is very funny, or, you know. We talk about things as if, you know, people have some kind of character that is them. But is that true? Is that true? If we look inside of ourselves, don't we have many totally opposite characteristics? You know, we don't have any kind of individual personality or character, do we? We might have tendencies, but what are tendencies? Tendencies are only certain moments of action or certain moments of mind that have some similarity to each other. You know, we say somebody's an angry person. What's anger? Anger isn't something there. It's just certain moments of mind that don't happen continuously, you know, that happen periodically, that have some similarity to each other. And in dependence upon that, we call that anger. Or other times, there's other characteristics that have some similarity to each other, and we call it kindness. Is a person, does they have a personality of anger? Do they have a personality of kindness? We aren't our anger. We aren't our kindness. Yeah? What's the ego? You know, this is what we're analyzing to try and find what we think there's an ego there. But let's look for it. You know, first of all, what's our idea of an ego? Some kind of, you know, thing that's there that exists by itself that is truly me. Well, search for that and try and find it. Okay? We can have names for lots of things that don't exist, like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Okay, there's a name, but it doesn't exist. Yeah. So we're checking, we're investigating here. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask: isn't there evidence that we have character in that we make decisions, that we have thoughts and experiences, that we make decisions, and that seems to be evidence that there is some kind of character there.
Okay. So we make decisions. So doesn't that mean that there's some character? There might be something that we call character, you know, something that's labeled character. But can you find anything that is character? Or who makes a decision? This is a real interesting one. We say, I make a decision. Who's the I that makes the decision? When you know, we make a decision, aren't there just various mental states, mental factors that kind of came together in a certain order or a certain combination? And in dependence upon that, a decision was made. And then we say, I made a decision. But can you find an I that makes a decision? Okay? So we talk about things, you know, but things are merely labeled. There's not findable fixed entities. Okay? How does karma play into it? Because karma is one of the conditioning things. Karma conditions us, but karma also is changing all the time. Karma just